I thought, you know, when I talked this 10 years ago, they didn't have what we've got now. So this is a 12-minute thing from the Bible Project. How many of you?
I've watched it recently.
Oh, you watched it?
It was really good.
Kind of summarizes.
And I was going to do it up here, but as always, when it's me and technology, we have a problem. You know, I tell people, I want them down here at 8:30 to make sure this works. Well, they were here at 8:30 and they couldn't make it work. I tell people, I flew to Phoenix, Arizona one time to give a briefing, and I took a laptop. And when I got there, I couldn't get the laptop to work. So I just had to come back, and I was in a room with Raytheon engineers that couldn't get it to work. And the problem was the guy that set the thing up for us didn't tighten the screws that hold the hard drive in. And the hard drive had backed out during the flight, and they said, "You just got a dead laptop there. It's useless, you know." So I'm technologically challenged, okay? But this is the Bible Project. It's excellent. You can get to it at home. And
YouTube.
You can review any book in the Bible in about 5 or 10 minutes.
Yes,
so we're going to see if this works.
You guys might want to move over here in the front row. Y'all going to be looking at it slant-eyed.
We will see if this works.
It's a profound and very unique book in the Bible for lots of reasons. The story is set in a very obscure land that's far away from Israel, Uz. The main character, Job, he's not even an Israelite, and the author, who's anonymous, doesn't even set the story in any clear period of ancient history. This all seems intentional, though. It's like the author doesn't want us to be distracted by historical questions, but rather to focus simply on the story of Job and on the questions raised by his experience of suffering. The book of Job has a very clear literary design. It opens and closes with a short narrative prologue and then an epilogue. And then the central body of the book is dense Hebrew poetry, representing conversations between Job and four dialogue partners called friends. These conversations are then concluded by a series of poetic speeches given by God to Job. Let's dive in and we'll just see how it works together. The prologue introduces us to Job, and we're told that he's a blameless, upright man who honors God and is a super good guy. And then all of a sudden, we're transported into the heavenly realms, and God is holding court with his staff team. It's a very common image in the Old Testament, describing how God runs the world. And among the heavenly beings is a figure called the Satan, which in Hebrew means the accuser or the prosecutor. And it's like we're watching a court scene. God presents Job as a truly righteous man, and then the accuser challenges God's policy of rewarding righteous people like Job. He says, "The only reason Job obeys you is because you bless him with prosperity. Let Job suffer, then we'll see how righteous he actually is." And then God agrees to let the accuser inflict suffering on Job. Now, it's at this point in the story that most of us go, "What? Why did God do that?" And then we assume that this book is going to answer that question, why God allows good people to suffer. But as you read on, the book doesn't answer that question. Nothing in the book ever answers that question. The prologue is setting up the real questions this book is trying to get at. Questions about God's justice and whether God operates the universe according to the strict principle of justice. And the response to those questions comes as you read through to the end of the book, not at the beginning. The ultimate reason for Job's suffering is simply never revealed. So the prologue concludes with a suffering and bewildered Job, who's rebuked by his wife, and he's approached by three friends who are going to try and provide wisdom and counsel. Their names are Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamathite. They're all non-Israelites like Job. And they represent the best of ancient Near Eastern thinking about God and suffering and the human condition, and this moves us into the main part of the book. First, Job speaks. And this is how the section of the book works. First, Job is going to speak, and then they'll follow a response from a friend. Then Job will respond to that friend. Then another friend will respond to Job's response, and so on back and forth for three cycles. And this whole debate is focused on three questions. Is God truly just in character? And does God run the universe on the strict principle of justice? And if so, then how is Job's suffering to be explained? As we're going to see, Job and the friends, they're working from a huge assumption about what God's justice ought to look like in the world. Namely, that every single thing that happens in the universe should operate according to the strict principle of justice. So if you're a wise, good person and you honor God, good things will happen to you. God will reward you. But if you're evil and stupid and do sinful things, bad things will happen to you. God will punish you. Now, Job's constant argument throughout his speeches is this. First of all, that he's innocent, and so the implication of that is that his suffering is not a divine punishment. Now, we know from the prologue, both of these things are true. Remember, God himself said, Job is righteous and blameless. And so Job concludes his argument by accusing God. God either doesn't run the world according to justice, or even worse, God himself is simply unjust. The friends, on the other hand, they beg to differ. Their argument is that God is just, the implication being that God always runs the world according to justice in this way. And so they conclude by accusing not God, but Job. Job must have done something really, really bad for God to punish him like this. They even start making up possible sins that Job must have committed. Job protests to all of this. In fact, he gets so fed up with the friends that he eventually just gives up on them. He takes up his case directly with God. Now, something to be aware of is that Job, he's on an emotional roller coaster in these poems. He used to think that God is just, but now he can't reconcile that with his suffering. And so in some outbursts, Job, he'll accuse God of being a bully. Once he even declares that God has orchestrated all the injustice in the world. But the moment he utters that thought, he's terrified of it because he wants to hope and believe that God is truly just. Job is all over the place in this section. And so, he makes one last statement of his innocence, and then he demands that God show up personally to explain himself. Now, it's at this point that a surprise friend shows up, Elihu the Buzite. Now, he's not an Israelite, but he does have a Hebrew name. And Elihu, he has the same assumption as Job and the friends. He argues that God is just, and that that implies that God always operates the universe according to justice. But then Elihu draws a more sophisticated conclusion about why good people suffer. It may not be punishment for sin in the past. God might inflict suffering as a warning to help people avoid sin in the future. Or God might use pain and suffering to build character or to teach people valuable lessons. Elihu doesn't claim to know why Job is suffering, but one thing he is certain of, Job is wrong to accuse God of being unjust. Job doesn't even respond to Elihu, and the dialogues come to a close. It's like the wisdom of the ancients has been spent, and the mystery remains. And then, all of a sudden, God shows up in a whirlwind, and he responds to Job personally. He first responds to Job's accusation that he's unjust and incompetent at running the universe. So God takes Job on a virtual tour of the universe, and he starts asking him all these questions about the order and origins of the cosmos. Was Job ever around when God architected the earth or organized the constellations? Has Job ever commanded the sunrise or controlled the weather? God has his eyes on all of these cosmic details that Job has never even conceived of. Then God starts going into detail, describing the grazing habits of mountain goats and how deer give birth, or the feeding patterns of lions and wild donkeys. What's the point of all this? Remember the assumption of Job and his friends about what it looks like for God to run the world according to justice. Underneath that assumption is a deeper one, that Job and his friends have a wide enough perspective on life to make such a claim about how God ought to run the world. And God's response with this virtual tour, it deconstructs all of these assumptions. It first of all shows that the universe is a vast, complex place, and that God has his eyes on all of it, every detail. Job, on the other hand, has only the small horizon of his life experience to draw from. His view of the world is very limited. And so what looks like divine injustice, from Job's point of view, needs to be seen in an infinitely larger context. Job is simply not in a position to make such a huge accusation about God. After the virtual tour, God asks Job if he would like to micromanage the world for a day, according to the strict principle of justice that Job and his friends assume, punishing every evil deed of every person at every moment with precise retribution. The fact is that carrying out justice in a world like ours is extremely complex. It's never black and white, like Job and the friends seem to think. Which leads to God's last point. he starts describing these two fantastic creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan, which some people think are poetic depictions of a hippo and a crocodile, but more likely they refer to well-known creatures from ancient Near Eastern mythology that are used elsewhere in the Bible as symbols of the disorder and danger that exist in God's good world. These creatures, they're not evil. God's actually quite proud of them, but they're not safe either. The point is that God's world is amazing and very good, but it's not perfect or always safe. God's world has order and beauty, but it's also wild and sometimes dangerous, just like these two fantastic creatures. And so we come back to the big question of Job's suffering. Why is there suffering in God's world? Whether it's from earthquakes or wild animals or from other humans, God doesn't explain why. What he says is that we live in an extremely complex, amazing world that at this stage, at least, is not designed to prevent suffering. And that's God's response. Job challenged God's justice. God responds that Job doesn't have sufficient knowledge about our universe to make such a claim. Job demanded a full explanation from God. And what God asked Job for is trust in his wisdom and character. And so, Job responds with humility and repentance. He apologizes for accusing God, and he acknowledges that he's overstepped his bounds. Then all of a sudden, the book concludes with a short epilogue. First, God says that the friends were wrong, that their ideas about God's justice were just too simple, not true to the complexity of the world or God's wisdom. And then God says that Job has spoken rightly about him. Now, this is surprising because it can't apply to everything Job said. I mean, we know Job drew hasty and wrong conclusions, but God still approves of Job's wrestling, how Job came honestly before God with all of his emotion and pain and simply wanted to talk to God himself. And God says that's the right way to process through all of this, through the struggle of prayer. The book concludes with Job having his health, his family, his wealth, all restored, not as a reward for good behavior, but simply as a generous gift from God, and that's the end of the book. So the book of Job, it doesn't unlock the puzzle of why bad things happen to good people. Rather, it does invite us to trust God's wisdom when we do encounter suffering, rather than try and figure out the reasons for it. When we search for reasons, we tend to either simplify God, like the friends, or like Job, accuse God, but based on limited evidence. And so the book is inviting us to honestly bring our pain and our grief to God and to trust that God actually cares and that he knows what he's doing. And that's what the book of Job is all about.
Okay. I apologize for the intermittent technology here and for the screaming child out in the hall. I wish I could have controlled the volume a little better, but I hope y'all benefited from that. It's a good summary. And if you want to see it again, you can go home and just type in BibleProject.com. You can find it for this book or any other book of the Bible. So it's I think it's fun to watch, and it's entertaining, and learn something. Get another perspective on the book of Job. Okay, we're ready to take off. We got through round one of the debate, through the 14th chapter. We talked about the 14th chapter was an interlude on a lament about man's suffering. Man's condition in the world is that he suffers and he doesn't know why, you know. And so there are two of these in the book. 14 and chapter 28 stops the dialogue and just is a poem about suffering or a poem about wisdom. And we'll get to 28 later, but I want us to pick up in chapter 15 and just read through this and take each response, Job and then Eliphaz and Job and Bildad, and try to get through chapter 21 if we can today. I'll start out by reading the 15th chapter and allow you to make some observations or comments, and I'll make a couple. And then I want Janice, night before last, Janice pointed out to me that I was talking to her. I alluded in an earlier chapter to the fact that a lot of the Bible scholars think there is a problem with the 27th chapter of Job. they think there is a contradiction there, so they all come up with different reasons why that's there. And I've got my reason. It's not like any of theirs. And when we get there, I'll talk to you about it. But I was telling her about that. She said she'd never heard of that, so I went to Erdman's Bible Handbook. And sure enough, Erdman says, yes, probably a contradiction here in the 28th chapter, and it's probably an error in the text. And so I wanted to share Erdman with you, but as I realized that Erdman gives a nice little summary of every speech in the debate. And so just about two or three sentences, and I'm going to let Janice read that after we've discussed each chapter, okay, or each debate. I'm going to start with Eliphaz's second response to Job in chapter 15. Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "Would a wise man answer with empty notions, or fill his belly with a hot east wind? Would he argue with useless words, with speeches that have no value? But you even undermine piety and hinder devotion to God. Your sin prompts your mouth. You adopt the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you and not mine. Your own lips testify against you. Are you the first man ever born? Were you brought forth before the hills? Do you listen in on God's counsel? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What insights do you have that we do not have? The gray-haired and the aged are on our side, men even older than your father. Are God's consolations not enough for you, words spoken gently to you? Why has your heart carried you away? Why do your eyes flash so that you vent your rage against God and pour out such words from your mouth? What is man that he could be pure, or one born of woman that he could be righteous? If God places no trust in his holy ones, if even the heavens are not pure in his eyes, how much less man who is vile and corrupt, who drinks up evil like water? Listen to me. I will explain to you. Let me tell you what I have seen. What wise men have declared, hiding nothing received from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, when no alien passed among them. All his days the wicked man suffers torment. The ruthless through all the years stored up for him. Terrifying sounds fill his ears. When all seems well, marauders attack him. He despairs of escaping the darkness. He is marked for the sword. He wanders about, food for vultures. He knows the day of darkness is at hand. Distress and anguish fill him with terror. They overwhelm him like a king poised to attack. Because he shakes his fist at God and vaunts himself against the Almighty, defiantly charging against him with a thick, strong shield. Though his face is covered with fat and his waist bulges with flesh, he will not inhabit. He will inhabit ruined towns, houses where no one lives, houses crumbling to rubble. He will no longer be rich, and his wealth will not endure, nor will his possessions spread over the land. He will not escape the darkness. A flame will wither his shoots, and the breath of God's mouth will carry him away. Let him not deceive himself by trusting what is worthless, for he will get nothing in return. Before his time, he will be paid in full, and his branches will not flourish. He will be like a vine stripped of its unripe grapes, like an olive tree shedding its blossoms. For the company of the godless will be barren, and the fire will consume the tents of those who love bribes. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil. Their womb fashions deceit." Okay, so Job, Eliphaz really blasts Job here, you know. I think that one thing we'll see, all of the Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar follow a pretty consistent pattern. First, they rebuke Job and tell him that he's sinful for shaking his fist at God and crying out, looking for answer. Then they give him advice. This is what happens if you repent, and this is what happens if you don't repent. And then they'll either go into a long list of things that God will do for him, for the righteous, or they'll go into a long list of things that God does to the wicked. So this speech is identical. I mean, it's the same thing Eliphaz said the first time. Okay? Another thing I notice is these guys, if Job says, let me find my place here. If Job says that he is tormented, the friends say, God torments the wicked. If Job says, I'm suffering, the friends say, God makes the wicked suffer. So they use whatever Job says against him, you know. You notice in verse 20, he talks about torment, terror in 21 and 24, loss of wealth in 29. All of those things are the exact problem Job says he has, you know. So Eliphaz looks at Job and he sees a wicked person. That's what he sees, because he has concluded that Job is... and I like verse 11 and 12 here. Job is sitting here suffering miserably. And Eliphaz says, are God's consolations not enough for you? Words spoken gently to you. You know, I don't think Job thinks that what God's doing to him is words spoken gently at all, you know. So in their attempt to get Job to admit that he's a sinner and deserving of his punishment, they're extremely cruel to him, you know. Let me see where I am now. I get lost in my notes.
Their statements make such contrast to the friend's statements about Job is in contrast to what God sees in Job. And it's amazing because they're close friends.
Yeah. Another thing I've noticed is they start out, they speak in the third person. They're talking, and Janice can correct me if I get this wrong. They talk about what the wicked, what they do and what happens to him. And then they start talking, or they'll say, but they get to you. And by the third round of the debate, they're so frustrated that they can't convince Job that they start accusing, you did these, Job, you do these things, you know, rather than the wicked does. They get more and more personal in their attacks of Job. Now I'm going to let Janice read this. It's about two sentences. What the Erdman's Bible, what a handbook says about about chapter 15 here.
Eliphaz's second speech. The debate grows more heated. Job has needled his friends, and they make no allowances for the stress he is under. It never crosses their minds he may really be innocent. They go on doggedly defending their position and trying to bludgeon Job into submission. Job is self-opinionated and a self-opinionated old windbag. All he has said, his wild accusations against God, his attempts to justify himself, merely serve to prove his guilt. Job is wrong in saying that the wicked get off scot-free. Their fate is a terrible one.
Okay, so let's see what Job says to Eliphaz in round two. I need two readers. One to read a chapter, read chapter 16, and somebody to read chapter 17 for the class. Two volunteers. Got them one here. You read 16?
Okay.
Who will read 17? 17?
Then Job replied, I have heard many things like these. Miserable comforters are you all. Will your long-winded speeches never end? What ails you when you keep on arguing? I also could speak like you. If you were in my place, I could make fine speeches against you and shake my head at you. But my mouth would encourage you. Comfort from my lips would bring you relief. Yet if I speak, my pain is not relieved. And if I refrain, it does not go away. Surely, O God, you have worn me out. You have devastated my entire household. You have bound me, and it has become a witness. My gauntness rises up and testifies against me. God assails me and tears me in his anger and gnashes his teeth at me. My opponent fastens on me his piercing eyes. Men open their mouths to jeer at me.
They strike my cheek in scorn and unite together against me. God has turned me over to evil men and thrown me in the clutches of the wicked. All was well with me, but he shattered me. He seized me by the neck and crushed me. He has made me his target. His archers surround me. Without pity, he pierces my kidneys and spills my gall on the ground. Again and again, he bursts upon me and rushes at me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth over my skin and buried my brow in the dust. My face is red with weeping. Deep shadows ring my eyes. Yet my hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is true. O earth, do not cover my blood. I cry, never be laid to rest. Even now, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. My intercessor is my friend. As my eyes pour out tears to God, on behalf of a man, he pleads with God, as a man pleads for his friend. Only a few years will pass before I go on the journey of no return.
Okay.
My spirit is broken, my days are cut short, the grave awaits me. Surely mockers surround me, my eyes must dwell on their hostility. Give me, O God, the pledge you demand. Who else will put up security for me? You have closed their minds to understanding. Therefore, you will not let them triumph. If a man denounces his friends for reward, the eyes of his children will fail. God has made me a byword to everyone. A man in his face, people spit. My eyes have grown dim with grief. My whole frame is but a shadow. Upright men are appalled at this. The innocent are aroused against the ungodly. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to their ways, and those with clean hands will grow stronger. But come on, all of you, try again. I will not find a wise man among you. My days have passed, my plans are shattered, and so are the desires of my heart. These men turn night into day. In the face of darkness, they say, light is near. If the only home I hope for is a grave, if I spread out my bed in darkness, if I say to corruption, you are my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? Will it go down to the gates of death? Will we descend together into the dust?
Okay. So he starts out by addressing his friends. He says, you guys are miserable comforters. He said, if I was in your place and you were in my place, I would try to comfort you, okay? And then he turns to God and he says, surely, God, you've worn me out. I have to make sure I get my literary term right, but he uses a lot of hyperbole. Is that exaggeration? God has made him his opponent. Job has become God's target in verse 12. He describes a battle scene where, warriors pierce one another's kidney and spill one another's gall, seize one another by the neck. So he sees himself in a struggle with God. In verse 10 and 11, he may be referring to the friends there when he says, God's turned me over to evil men, because they're tormenting him, trying to help him, So, and then in verse 17, he says he still believes he's a nonviolent man whose prayers to God are pure. So he's still clinging to his integrity. And that's what he's done from the beginning, and that's what he does throughout the poem. Then out of the depths of his suffering comes this cry of hope, this tremendous cry in verses 18 through 21. He says, may my cry never be laid to rest. Even now, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. My intercession is my friend. As my eyes pour out tears to God, on behalf of a man, he pleads with God as a man pleads with his friend. So here's this tremendous messianic claim that he knows he has an advocate in heaven.
How do you know that?
He doesn't. He doesn't know it's messianic. Okay. You know? I don't think Isaiah knew it was messianic, but Isaiah is full of messianic things.
That was the question I was going to ask. How did he know that somebody was in heaven?
Well, and it's a good question. How does he know that he has an advocate in heaven? Because it hasn't been revealed to us in Scripture yet, right? We don't know that till we get to the gospel.
And it says Christ goes backwards looking for.
But I think, and I'll get ahead of myself here, I think it has to do with his faith. The righteous live by faith.
Okay. So he thinks righteous man.
So he cannot accept that God's going to leave him in this condition. God will ultimately vindicate him. And he says that. And this has been coming on from the beginning in chapter 9, verses 33 and 35, he longs for an arbitrator. He says, if only there's an arbitrator between man and God. Then in chapter 13, he said he has a hope. Let me turn there, back to 13, verses 15. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. That will turn out to be my deliverance. For no godless man will dare come before him. So he knows eventually he's got to be vindicated, you know. This is what he believes about God. Chapter 14, he says, God, if you would only hide me in the grave until your wrath is past, and then bring me forth. There's a great hope in that, in this chapter that's basically despairing man's condition. Call me forth, and you'll be pleased with the creature your hands have made, you know. And then 16, he has an advocate in heaven. And we'll jump ahead here just to look at the climax of the book is in chapter 19, verses 23 through 27. He says, oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. That's a tremendous messianic passage, right? I mean, how could, you know, it's all here. The gospel is here, right? Here is a redeemer. Here is a judgment. And here is vindication. Everything is a bodily resurrection, a final judgment, where the righteous are vindicated and rewarded. So, and like I said, in response to your question, there are a lot of places where the prophets spoke, and they didn't have a clear understanding. You know, they spoke about pointing to things coming, but they didn't understand why. But it was the Spirit. You know, the Spirit acting. So, but I think that these passages that we just reviewed here reveal the heart of Job, and they're part of the keys to understanding the poem. He is a righteous man, and he never gives up on God. If he's not vindicated in this life, God will vindicate him in heaven. And I think that's what it's about. Another key to understanding Job is to look at his hope. Job has a hope versus the hope of those who look at life without regard to God. Okay, I'm reminded of Ecclesiastes. Let me flip over there. Right
there. Well, what David Platt said last week is applicable here, where He talked a little bit about Ecclesiastes, but he said what the Ecclesiastes shows is that life with no reference to God is meaningless.
Yeah.
And Job always reserves the fact that what makes life and meaning is God.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to say. David Platt said, remember, life under the sun in Ecclesiastes is kind of a code for life without regard to God. And that's what the whole theme of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 9, starting in verse 3, he says, "This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live. Afterward, they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing." So what he's saying is, there's no hope with death. Without regard to God, life under the sun, the wicked have hope, but it dies with them in the grave. Okay? Job says his hope endures. It's an eternal hope, a hope in eternity. Do you see the difference in those two hopes? I think
so
that's
there is something new under the sun.
Yeah. But, and David said that.
Yeah, and he said it was Jesus.
Yeah. I found this. This is another thing I think sort of points out the difference between the hope of the wicked and the hope of the righteous. In Proverbs, I noticed this, I'd underline this. In the 24th chapter, and he's talking about gaining wisdom, the value of wisdom, and I think it's synonymous with gaining righteousness, okay? He says, "Know also that wisdom is sweet to your soul. If you find it, there is a future hope for you, and your hope will not be cut off." What is a future hope? You know, it's a hope that will endure, okay? Down in verse 24 of that same chapter, now wait a minute, that's not right, verse 20 of that chapter, he says, "The evil man has no future hope. The lamp of the wicked will be snuffed out." So, you see the difference in the wicked man hopes, but his hope dies in this life. But Job has a hope that will endure to eternity. And I think that's one of the keys to the book, is to look at the difference between the hope of the wicked. The wicked have hope because Ecclesiastes says where there's life, there's hope. You know, a live dog's better than a dead lion, you know. But the wicked's hope dies when he dies. It goes to the grave. And you'll see little snippets of that throughout the book of Job. He'll be talking about his suffering or something, and suddenly there'll be this little passage. Say, well, why did he say that? You know, and if you think about it, he's pointing out the difference between his hope and the hope of the wicked. In chapter 17, he continues to complain to his friends and plead with God. He calls his friends mockers in verse 2. Verse 3, Job wants God to just tell him what's wrong. You know, don't keep tormenting me. Let me get back to Job here. I have a hard time jumping around. This where he talks about his hope here, he says that if the only home I hope for is the grave, if I spread out my bed with darkness, if I say to corruption, you're my father, and to the worm, you're my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? It will go down to the grave. That's his hope will go down to the grave of death. We will ascend together into the dust. So Job is saying, I am not going to cast my lot with the wicked because I'm going to keep this eternal hope of heaven. That's what he's saying to me, anyway. Janice Reed Erdman.
Here. Okay. Job's reply: "It is cold comfort his friends have to give. How easy for them to talk when it is Job who bears the pain. Like many sense their silent sympathy." And 2:13 helped more than their well-meaning words. God has worn him out with suffering and the cruelty of his fellow men. The pictures Job paints, 16:9, 12-14, convey his intense, unbearable agony, a tortured body, and a mind tormented at the thought that God could do all of this to him. Even now, he cannot believe God is unjust. There must be one who will plead his cause in heaven. chapter 19, and see John, verse 19, see John, 1 John 2, 1. If his case rests till he is dead, what hope is there? Chapter 17, 13 through 16. And in 17:3, who does God speak to? And who does Job speak to? Job speaks to God.
And 1 John 2?
Yeah, it's about the advocate. If we do sin, we have an advocate.
We have an advocate.
Before the Father, yeah. Jesus Christ the righteous.
Okay, so any comments or thoughts or rebuttals so far? We'll just keep going. I need a reader to read Bildad's response to Job now.
I'll read it.
Okay.
Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, "When will you end these speeches? Be sensible and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as cattle and considered stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself to pieces in your anger, is the earth to be abandoned for your sake? Or must the rocks be moved from their place? The lamp of the wicked is snuffed out, the flame of his fire stops burning. The light of his tent becomes dark. The lamp beside him goes out. The vigor of his step is weakened. His own schemes throw him down. His feet thrust him into a net, and he wanders into its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel. A snare holds him fast. A noose is hidden for him on the ground. A trap lies in his path. Terrors startle him on every side and dog his every step. Calamity is hungry for him, disaster is ready for him when he falls. It eats away parts of his skin, death's firstborn devours his limbs. He is torn from the security of his tent and marched off to the king of terrors. Fire is sighs in his tent, burning, sulfur is scattered over his dwelling. His roots dry up below and his branches wither above. The memory of him perishes from the earth. He has no name in the land. He is driven from light into darkness and is banished from the world. He has no offspring or descendants among his people, no survivor where once he lived. Men of the west are appalled at his fate. Men of the east are seized with horror. Surely is such the dwelling of an evil man, such is the place of one who knows not God."
So Bildad's address is identical to Eliphaz, right? He doesn't say anything new. He doesn't add to the debate in any way. He rebukes Job, and then he just repeats this long litany of things that's going to happen to the wicked man. I had a thought. You know, we say the Bible is truth, but everything you read in the Bible is not truth, right? Do you see the difference there? Job's friends say a lot of things that are true, but the overall content of what they're saying is in error. Do you see that? So be careful when you quote Job. Sometimes you're quoting the friends, you know.
He's actually on a rant here.
Yeah. But he uses hyperbole to describe what happens to the wicked. He brings up Job's children again. They love to torment Job about the children he's lost. He gives a neat little summation in verse 21, you know. "Surely such is the dwelling of an evil man, such is the place of one who knows not God."
It talks about the memory of him perishes from the earth.
Yeah.
That happens to everybody.
Right.
Because I was thinking about my grandchildren and their children don't know my mom and dad and don't even have any concept of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so true. Uh-huh. It doesn't just happen to the wicked, it happens to all of us, doesn't uh-huh. it? My granddaughter sitting here, she has no idea of the life that my mother had.
Right.
You know, she has very little knowledge of my mother.
And we bring out old photos and they look so strange we don't even know what to explain it to them.
I was telling my granddaughter-in-law, who just had a new baby, about when Charlie and I had our first one. how different it is. Mm. No pampers, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And they think they have it hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell, when mine were born, the men sat outside. Uh-huh. And the doctor or the nurse brought out the baby and held it up to you after two or three hours, you know. And now they want the man in there with the woman in the delivery room.
And completely. The man gets 4 weeks off.
Yeah.
From work.
And I went to work the next day. So it's a different world. The world is always changing. And my grandkids don't have a clue what a farm life is like.
No.
You know, I grew up with pigs and turkeys and chickens and cows.
I didn't either, so I'm older than you.
But you learned,
don't you? Not much.
No.
But if you look at Bildad in verse 11, 12, and 13, he's describing Job. This is what I see in you, Job. So he is saying the same thing that Eliphaz just said. Okay? And I think Eliphaz is the most... he says the most, and Bildad and Zophar say less and less, and just basically repeat what Eliphaz says, you know.
It sounds like they just like to hear their own voice.
Yeah.
Keep on saying the same thing.
Well, they're theologians.
And Erdman's just gives a little bit here.
Okay, what is Erdman's?
To Bildad's speech. Bildad's second speech. Bildad bitterly resents Job's angry rejection of their advice. He replies by painting a terrible picture of the fate of the wicked, meant to put Job in his place. But Job is innocent, and Bildad's tirade is irrelevant to him.
Yeah, okay. One other comment on Bildad's speech here. He says in verse 13, talking about disaster, says it eats away parts of his skin. Job has already complained about that. But he refers to death, firstborn devours his limbs. What do you think death's firstborn is?
Eve.
What?
Death's firstborn.
Yeah.
Eve, wasn't it?
Eve. Well, I don't think that's what he's referring to.
Okay. Well, tell us.
I think he's saying any disease that's terminal is death's the firstborn, right? That's my interpretation. So anything that is a terminal disease, that's the firstborn of death. That's you're going there, okay? So that's what he's saying there. Okay, let's read Job's reply to Bildad. Can somebody read that chapter for the class?
I got a loud mouth.
Yeah, go ahead. Chapter 19.
How long will you torment me and crush me with these words? 10 times now you've reproached me. Shamelessly you attack me. If it is true that I've gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. If indeed you would exalt yourselves above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. Though I cry violence, I get no response. Though I call for help, there's no justice. He has blocked my way so I cannot pass. He has shrouded my paths in darkness. He has stripped me of my honor and removed the crown from my head. He tears me down on every side till I'm gone. He uproots my hope like a tree. That said, he uproots my hope like a tree. My anger burns against him. Against me. He counts me among his enemies. He's still talking about God, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
His troops advance in force. They build a siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. He has alienated my family from me. My acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have gone away. My closest friends have forgotten me. My guests and my female servants count me a foreigner. They look on me as a stranger. I summon my servant, but he does not answer, though I beg him with my own mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own family. Even the little boys scorn me when I appear. They ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me, my friends. Have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead, or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end, he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, and I, not another. How my heart yearns within me. If you say, how will we hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him? You should fear the sword yourselves, for wrath will bring punishment by the sword, and then you will know that there is judgment.
Okay, so Job is continuing to complain about his suffering, but his suffering is much more than his physical suffering, right? He's isolated from the people that he loves. He's closed in on himself, I think is what Erdman described. He says, 10 times now you've reproached me. We see that in other places in the Old Testament. That just means you've reproached me a bunch of times, right? I think Laban and Jacob accused each other of sinning against them 10 times, you know. Just means a bunch of times. Then in verse 6, he turns to God and he says, God's wronged him. God stripped him of honor and removed his crown. That's in verse 9. And you know, the crown is your dignity. He has no dignity. I think that's it's pitiful when you see somebody that's had a dignified life and suffering and disease comes and just robs them of their dignity.
I wondered if Job ate during this time.
Job ate? Uh-huh. I don't know. I think he said it. So I remember him saying something about his food doesn't taste too good, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Skin and bones. So if he did, he didn't eat much.
Yeah.
Doctor.
But he makes a bad assumption in verse 11. He says God is angry with him. God has made him his enemy. And I think that is one of the assumptions that Job has made that proves to be incorrect. And I think that's one of the lessons we learn in the book of Job, is when suffering comes, that is not an indication of God's disapproval, okay, or his anger with you, or his rejection of you.
So you shouldn't say, why is God doing this to me?
Yeah, well, yeah.
We all
do that, right?
Tend to anyway.
But he says his brothers, his kinsmen, yes, his servants, his wife, even the little boys find him detestable and scorn him and ridicule him. Verse 20, you read that a lot in English literature about escaping with the skin of your teeth and being skin and bones. I think Shakespeare uses that about the skin of your teeth.
What do they mean by skin of your teeth?
Well, the commentary says your gums.
Oh, okay.
But you always think, well, teeth don't have skin, right? So, yeah, he's lost his teeth, probably, you know. Oh. He's just down to his gums.
Well, what kids would say that it was meant, you barely made it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We got there by the skin
of our teeth.
We were saved by the skin of our teeth.
He pleads with his friends for pity in verses 22 and 21 and 22. And I do believe that the climax of the book is verses 23 through 27. He has this confidence in ultimate vindication even beyond the grave. That's the basis for the song we sing, I Know That My Redeemer Lives. It comes from Job. So you see his friend's theology come again in verse 28. If you say, how we will hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him. They're saying, Job, your problem is Job. You're the problem. And so that's what they've been arguing from the beginning of the poem. Read Erdman for us.
Okay. Job's friends have become his tormentors, leveling false accusations and offering no answer to his desperate questions. He is shut in on himself, despairing, utterly alone. He has become an object of loathing to those he loves most. Even pity is denied him. Yet even in his darkest moments, faith and hope still well up inside of him. He is certain of vindication. One day, God himself will take up his case and clear it and he will be there to see it. Then those who have maligned him will find themselves answerable to God.
Okay, we're almost out of time. We didn't get as far as we wanted. I'm struggling a little bit with reading through this, but I think it's beneficial.
Yeah,
we're going to keep going like that because, you know, I can go back and make summary points about it, and we can read Erdman, but you get the whole effect if we just read through the text, and I think that's really
important. You always want to go to the original text if you want a deep understanding of any literature.
Okay, so we're going to start next week with Zophar's second reply here, and we'll...
And if you gave us homework to read, and I did like you said, I wouldn't remember it by the time I got here.
So. Right. Amen.
Okay, so we're going to finish round two of the debate and try to get round three behind us because we got to get to Job's concluding comments and Elihu and God in the whirlwind. This is the seventh class. We've got six more classes. So we'll get there.